I've been a reporter for a long time. And for much of my career here in my hometown of Chicago, I've reported on race. I've done stories on housing, segregation, food injustice, economic development. It's been so fulfilling. But something you likely don't know about me and maybe don't expect, I am a huge soap opera fan. And I mean huge. You might be thinking, so what? Soaps are known for the absurd, people returning from the dead, amnesia is a popular plot device, possession by the devil. Sometimes the acting is overwrought. Chalk it up to all the lines that must be memorized. There are no reruns, therefore stories without end. 250 episodes a year. I argue that there is a deeper picture of the daytime drama, an important part of American television history and popular culture. Not to mention the social issues soaps tackled before other shows. Abortion, divorce, and queer representation have been front burner stories with fleshed out characters and storylines played out over months, not just one very special episode. Soap operas are a part of families and childhoods. We age with those characters and families who've been around for decades. Those bonds are strong. I want you, dear listener, to join me on this journey where I argue that soaps have not gotten the credit they deserve. They're dismissed as lowbrow entertainment for women. Yet, as you'll learn throughout this season of making Stories Without End, soaps are the foundation for American television storytelling and served as a financial powerhouse to the networks for decades. Without soaps, we wouldn't have dramas, reality shows. Without soaps, we wouldn't have many of the TV tropes and shows we love to stream and binge watch. Cliffhangers, serials, vixens, all come from soaps. On top of all that, I want to introduce you to the Chicago woman who doesn't get near enough credit for developing storytelling for the small screen. So settle in while I take you to the fictional Midwestern towns of Salem, Genoa City, Oakdale, and Springfield. My soap origin love story begins with our babysitter, Mrs. Rhymes. I've been watching soap since I was at least 5 years old. Specifically, All My Children. We were an ABC home. I learned the word blackmail from watching soaps when I asked Mrs. Rhymes what the word meant. We bonded over All My Children, One Life to Live,
Here's What to Do When You Don't Find the Rainbows,
and General Hospital. My paternal grandmother loved Guiding Light on CBS, so that's how I got exposed. I also watched with my mother, and that's typical. Viewers watched with their mothers and their grandmothers. I was that kid who asked for my nap time to be changed so I wouldn't miss All My Children. Then in elementary school, Mrs. Rhymes would give me soap updates when I got off the school bus. I wondered if any of this ever concerned my mother.
No. I guess I was pretty lenient with you. You just seemed like you were mature and just kind of knew what you wanted and you could understand or whatever. It just never really, it never bothered me, and it didn't seem like it really affected you. And I think a lot of times that stuff is something you don't understand anyway.
Right. I didn't understand blackmail, but this pretty much tracks for my mother. She never restricted what I could read either. Didn't blink when I picked up The Exorcist in fifth grade or Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye in sixth grade. So I was all in on soap content. On Chicago's urban radio station WGCI, a comedian who created a character named Tyrone gave an All My Children juicy recap daily at 3:30 p.m. My mother and I looked forward to these short updates in the 1980s. Speaking of radio, this is the medium that soaps got their start in. But before we get to that, I want to tell you a little broadcasting history. I'm talking to you on a podcast, just like radio did 100 years ago. It's intimate. It captures an audience. During America's radio boom, it became commonplace to sit around a radio every evening with the family and listen. That's owed in large part to the minstrel show, Amos and Andy.
Now listen, Amos. You just stick to me and you'll be rich. What would you think if you'd wake up some morning and put your hand in your pants pocket?
Two white minstrel performers debuted the show in 1928 for the NBC affiliate owned by the Chicago Daily News. Amos and Andy became broadcasting's first mass phenomenon. The actors spoke in stereotypical dialect. They were blackface performers, without the paint because they didn't need to, it was radio. But radio programmers were faced with a conundrum. The first wave feminist movement just came to a close. Women achieved the right to vote, and programmers needed to figure out how to appeal to them. They wouldn't dare move to earlier programming. Early radio was in the evening because executives were concerned housewives would not be able to concentrate on a program while doing their chores. So General Mills created the character Betty Crocker to give daily hints on how to shop and care for the home more efficiently.
Cream one cup of shortening, hot butter for flavor with two.
But then around 1930, a Chicago woman named Erna Phillips made a splash. Now Erna, she's as important as they come. You can't understand the history of soap operas in this country without knowing Erna. She would revolutionize television with a new form.
Erna Phillips is such a great character in her own right.
Elena Levine is a professor in media, cinema, and digital studies at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Like me, she's a huge soap fan. Levine turned fandom into scholarship. She's the author of the book, Her Stories, Daytime Soap Opera in U.S. Television History. Erna was born and raised in Chicago. She attended Northwestern University, the University of Illinois, and the University of Wisconsin. Before becoming the pioneering powerhouse behind soap operas on the radio, she taught speech in Dayton, Ohio.
She started out wanting to be an actress. Various people told her she was too plain and unattractive to have that kind of role, but radio had just come along, and she started working in radio. And she was working at WGN. She's from Chicago. And they asked her, would she create a daily kind of narrative scripted show for women who were, you know, working in the home during the day? And that was when she created Painted Dreams. And she wrote it as well as performed in it.
Painted Dreams aired 5 days a week on WGN Radio. With that daily scripted show, Erna birthed a genre known as the daytime serial. She wanted Painted Dreams to air nationwide, but she clashed with WGN.
She got in a fight with them about the ownership of the show because she wanted it to go nationwide. And she ended up leaving and creating a show at WMAQ called Today's Children, which was basically a remake of Painted Dreams. It was kind of the same characters.
That was in 1932.
Today's Children. An outstanding value. Never before a General Mills offer like this.
Daytime serials were live and often featured theater actors.
Edith has sensed Spunky's growing bewilderment and discontent at living in this house with her, while his father stays at a hotel. The complexities of the situation are...
They have a narrator who is usually a male voice. I mean, it was always a male voice in radio, who would sort of tell you what the characters were thinking or feeling or experiencing, which is very different from the way that television soap opera works.
No matter what it may do to this knob of rusted mine.
The storylines, however, were women-centered. In her unpublished autobiography, Erna talked about forgetting her fantasies and approaching reality. Painted Dreams and Today's Children were based on people she knew. At first, she was drawn to the classic childhood fantasy of And They Lived Happily Ever After. But then she realized she needed to do reality and not fantasy. Commercial goods companies took notice and realized the serial could be a conduit to their customers.
So the radio serials tended to be 15 minutes a day in terms of episode length. So they would often package a bunch of them together, usually four in an hour. They were sponsored by domestic goods kinds of manufacturers, companies like Procter & Gamble, Colgate-Palmolive, and those companies saw their purpose really as advertising their products. And so even though the episodes were 15 minutes long, probably at least 5 of those minutes was spent on these commercial announcements that would usually be at the beginning and the end, sometimes in the middle as well.
The stories were centered around families.
Sometimes around an individual woman who was the kind of center of the storyline. And either she herself would have all kinds of trials and problems, or she would be kind of the wise mothering figure to sometimes literally her own children, often adult, young adult children, and sometimes to a kind of larger community who would sort of come to her for guidance and help.
So soap operas got their names because soap companies sponsored them. Although Erna never used the term soap opera in her autobiography, she preferred serial and once said that the heart of the serial is the exchange of feeling and memories between two characters, and that any incident should not affect the handful of characters, but the whole community. Over her four-decade career, Erna wrote or created more than a dozen daytime serials, a stunning amount. Many old radio soaps are hard to find, and finding interviews of her is even harder. I stumbled on this, a very scratchy 1947 radio interview on the show Bob Elson on the Century. Erna responded to his question about what average daytime listeners want.
Well, I think they like to see reflected more or less their own problems, their own conflicts, their own heartache, their hopes, and their own dreams.
In other words, they don't want everything happiness.
Well, everything isn't happiness, is it?
No.
When we come back, Erna Phillips takes the city and the country by storm. Erna Phillips did not initially set out to appeal to women. She was just writing, and writing what she knew. But her central characters had a great appeal to women listeners. Let's be clear, men listen too. As a matter of fact, there are still plenty of male fans of the genre. Soap scholar Elena Levine says Erna was invested in traditional family structures.
In a lot of ways, her shows told stories that were somewhat traditional, conservative about those kinds of relationships and people. But of course, soap operas have to have a lot of drama. And so there would always be trouble in those marriages and in those families. But her really driving goal was to sort of always return to those sort of conventional nuclear family structures and to see the value in them.
I'm one of 10 children, the youngest of 10 children.
I see.
And I had a very wonderful mother, and so I had a very wonderful character called Mother Monahan.
Uh-huh.
Aunt Kate Green, who later became Mother Moran of today's children.
Erna said she did not consider herself well-versed in politics, but was acutely aware that President Roosevelt's New Deal was one of the great reform movements. That captivated her, so Mother Moran was a member of the Civic Club, a local political group. She did not portray her as an activist, but as a woman who was informed and interested in politics. Andrew Wyatt is a soap historian based in Chicago. He has studied how daytime serials became known as soaps. The term soap opera was popularized in the 1940s.
Otherwise, up until then, people usually call them washboard weepers, dishpan dramas, suffering sagas, matinee melodramas. I think there was one of sob stories.
By the 1950s, Wyatt says, a New Yorker article criticizing soaps began the modern-day stigma against the genre. It's unclear if that bothered Erna.
Erna always said it was just like daytime dramas, or as she put it, serials, are like ancient Greek dramas where you have characters who are not all bad or all good. They all have their high points, their low points, but you understand where they're coming from. And another thing, too, is that, you know, let's face it, they can be a little melodramatic, the serials. And at the same time, they're not all that different from ancient Greek drama.
At one time early on, Chicago was the mecca for the daytime serial. It dominated most of daytime radio. 50. That's right, 50 were on the air, and most originated from Chicago. Three of Erna's shows were consistently rated in the top 10, and one was usually number one. She was riding high on her success. She earned good money, negotiated with the big boys in a male-dominated entertainment field. Erna was a true businesswoman. But foes saw dollar signs. She wrote in her autobiography about a man who sued her, claiming half ownership of one of her shows. His attorney had clout. He was a boss in the notorious Chicago Democratic machine. She lost, but it didn't keep her from writing. One thing to keep in mind about her is that she never actually learned to type, despite writing millions of words a year. Erna dictated her scripts rapidly. Ken Corday's father, Ted Corday, worked for Erna as a director. The two of them created Days of Our Lives in 1965.
As a child, I remember her coming to New York annually to meet with the Procter & Gamble people all the way from Chicago. Erna was brilliant.
Now he is executive producer of Days of Our Lives.
Her imagination, more than her life experiences, created her shows. And she was very helpful with me sometimes with short stories I had to write in school. I would call her and say, you know, what do I do here, Erna? And she'd say, oh, here's ABC. And there was the story for me.
Tell me about, why did you know to call her for your school assignments?
My father told me to. He said, well, Erna's the writer, not me. Call Erna and tell her you're writing a story about a pigeon or an orange or, you know, gosh knows what. And I'd give her the beginning and the middle. She'd give me the rest of it and the end.
Erna was a pioneer in her personal life, too. She never married and adopted two children. Pretty bold in the 1940s. She moved to the West Coast, but felt people looked down on Midwesterners, so she returned to Chicago. Erna toggled back and forth over whether she even wanted to be married. She dated, she had an affair, but at the end of the day, she loved her independence. Some of that tension spilled over into her writing, Andrew Wyatt says.
She was trying to explore how divorce in a woman raising a child, you need both parents, or a masculine in a feminine force. But that was definitely from a lot of trauma, like the fact that she lost her father at the age of 8, which did a number on her. But she always wrote very strong women, nevertheless. And she always wrote very strong men. But she was concerned because she really felt that the bulwark of America was a strong family. Erna believed full-heartedly that if every household had loving parents demonstrated unconditional love, were always there for their kids, there will probably be no problems the next generation. Because she really felt that bad behavior in an adult started at home, always. You know, that's what she was getting at. You know, she did stand up to men, though. You know, you wouldn't call her a feminist, but she was very stubborn nevertheless.
When we come back, Erna Phillips goes to television. Elena Levine says among her quirks, Erna was also reportedly a hypochondriac.
She had various kinds of mental and physical health issues, became kind of obsessed with medicine and doctors. And I think a lot of the kind of medical and hospital-based storylines in soap opera then and through till the present are kind of thanks to her sort of interest in that world.
In 1937, Erna created The Guiding Light. She said it was at first a tribute to two nurses who she felt were responsible for saving her life when she was desperately ill. She lived a few blocks away from the People's Church in Chicago. That church, by the way, is still around today. The pastor was Preston Bradley. Erna was inspired by the non-denominational church. She created a show focused on a man named Reverend Rutledge,
who was sort of just that sort of moral authority figure for a community. And again, the radio serials often had these figures. Sometimes they were women, sometimes they were men. And he was definitely that kind of, you know, figure. And I think both he and perhaps the church that he was part of were supposed to literally be the guiding lights for the people around them to help them sort of see the way towards, you know, a just and happy existence. And so a lot of the show initially was about the community and the people in the community and the kinds of troubles they had and the way that he tried to help them.
On The Guiding Light, Erna named the working class neighborhood Five Points, a melting pot of white ethnics, Italian, German, Irish, Jewish, and Swedish families. Here's an episode in 1940 called Charles and Rose Have Dinner.
I don't think that I know how to be dishonest, really.
Then you, well, you must have answers to those questions. Rose, after our last meeting, I made up my mind that I wouldn't, that I couldn't phone you again.
And you didn't.
In her autobiography, Erna wrote how she was solely responsible for introducing something that came to annoy her and probably annoyed many listeners and viewers. Organ music as background. That came to be because Mary, Rutledge's daughter, was an organist at his church.
The guiding light.
Erna said she made her characters as simple or complex as real people. With The Guiding Light, she created characters that came from widely different social, cultural, and economic backgrounds. The Guiding Light is significant because it's the only radio soap to transition to television. The network was CBS. The year was 1952.
And now, The Guiding Light, created by Erna Phillips.
It was canceled in 2009, but it's important to note that the soap tackled social issues like no other program of its time and paved the way for Erna Phillips' proteges in Chicago. That's on the next episode of Making Stories Without End. Stories Without End is a production of WBEZ Chicago and part of the NPR network. I'm your host and writer, Natalie Moore. The show was produced by Hina Srivastava, edited by Ariel Van Cleve. It's mixed by Haley Bloomquist. We had music and production assistance from Justin Bull and Dave Miska. Thanks to Brendan Banizak. Our executive producer is Tracy Brown. Special thanks to Radio Echoes Audio and the University of Wisconsin-Madison Archives.